and welcome. I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. In episode 2 of Undisclosed series on the State versus Sean Thomas, we dove deeper into the investigation of the murder of Domingo Martinez, focusing on the nature of key confessions and the investigative and prosecutorial tactics used to convict Sean Thomas, a man who was ultimately freed in 2017, 23 years after being sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Now, with me today is one of the hosts of Undisclosed, Rabia Chaudhry. How you doing, Rabia?
Good. How are you, John?
Very well, very well. But also with us is James Figorsky. Jim was a Philadelphia police officer for 25 years. He graduated from Temple University's Beasley School of Law in 2005. And in 2009, Jim volunteered to assist the Pennsylvania Innocence Project to evaluate cases for merit. And subsequently, he ended up representing Sean Thomas. So Sean was your first Innocence Project case, Jim?
He was the first one who I actually represented, yes. I had seen several before him, John, but he was the first person I actually chose to represent.
Can you explain what is the process you go through in terms of selecting that, or was he assigned to you?
No, the initial process is that myself and other attorneys were asked to come into the offices at the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and we were asked to evaluate cases. And what we would do is we would read the application by the inmate and try to evaluate whether, in fact, he had a viable claim of innocence. If he was telling the truth, if he was asserting his actual innocence, and we would weed out people who, for whatever reason, were not claiming actual innocence. They were claiming that they were there, but they didn't fire the shot, things like that. But Sean Thomas's, and there were several at the same time that were evaluated by other people, but Sean in particular really struck me as being truthful. So I asked that Sean be promoted to the next level, which is a more intensive investigation, where we look into the actual trial, the transcript, we try to reenact the crime, and we were really struck by Sean's case, by the quality of his claims.
You actually try to reenact the crime? So you do actual investigative work like that?
Oh, yes. We work with law students, and we went out into North Philadelphia with cars, and we tried to do exactly what the Commonwealth said that Sean Thomas and his compatriots had done on November 13th, 1990, and we could not do it.
That's fascinating. I did not know that that was part of the process. I'm just a casual observer of these things and a fan of Undisclosed. But one would just assume that you're generally pouring through transcripts to try and find flaws in the court proceedings. But actually going out and doing field work like that is kind of surprising.
It was fun, too. I mean, we went out and interviewed people who had not been spoken to in 25 years. And like I said, we spent one whole day trying to reenact the entire crime from start to finish.
So you said that I saw pictures of the reenactment, but when you did the reenactment, you weren't able to do it. What part weren't you able to reenact? Like, what didn't fit?
Well, what the Commonwealth claimed at trial was that Sean and Mustafa Thomas and the Stallworth brothers and the other two people who were unknown males had followed the victim from the bank at 12th and Spring Garden, and that they were parked behind the bank. Someone went into the bank and saw the victim withdraw $25,000. That person came back to the other men in the cars and told them, Poppy got the money. And they supposedly followed him all the way through North Philadelphia. Well, we did exactly what William Stallworth testified to at trial. We parked behind the bank. We had someone go out front, and we tried to follow him through North Philadelphia. Not only could we not do it, but we knew actually where the victim was going because we knew the end story. And if you believe the Commonwealth, the people following him on the day of the murder didn't even know where he was, where he was headed that day. So William Stallworth actually testified that he went in the opposite direction from where the victim drove. And we tried to do that, and of course we couldn't. There's no way we could actually catch up with him.
Mm. Well, that's remarkable. Have you done that with other cases that you've pursued with the Innocence Project?
Not so far. That one was sort of unique, John, because of the extensive testimony about the cars and the route traveled and things like that. So, some of the other cases we've looked at didn't actually have that as a factor.
Does your experience as a police officer sort of inform how you do these things?
Well, in that case, it did, yes, because I had followed many people. I was in narcotics for years, so we followed people every day. And I knew the difficulty of following somebody in an urban area like that for miles and trying to stay with them. And as soon as I heard the story, I thought, that's pretty hard to do. Unless you have multiple cars in different locations picking him up. And when you consider that these cars were way behind him on a street behind the bank and that the victim had a head start by several minutes, there's no way they could have done this.
So a big part of the prosecution's case centered around the Youth Study Center, which to me actually is a kind of Orwellian name, first of all, for a place where young people are brought in and they're not studied, I don't think. And I don't think they're doing much studying. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? I mean, that wasn't a place where they were actually incarcerated. They were just, it was just a processing center.
It was actually both, John. It was, you know, part of the function of the Youth Study Center was as a jail in so many words, where youth who are awaiting trial or youth who are being sheltered from some home environment, you know, at least temporarily, were housed there in what's, you know, like a prison, basically, for juveniles. But it was also, you know, they had a courtroom there, and they would have, you know, preliminary hearings there for juveniles. And they also had the intake center, which is where Sean was the day of the murder. And the intake center is where the actual the decision to charge or not charge a juvenile is made.
So what would the procedure be? So he has to show up, I would imagine sign in some respect, and then just sit down and wait for somebody to take him into an office and deal with his case. Is that sort of what would happen?
Yes, that's correct. Anybody who's arrested in the 24-hour period before that intake process, he has to appear that day at 9 o'clock. And there, you know, I'm not sure how many people appeared on any given day, but any juvenile who had been arrested would show up. They would sign a log, from what I've been told by the people at the Youth Study Center, and they would be told to await the call of their case. And their cases would be numbered 1 through 30 or whatever it happened to be. Well, Sean's case apparently was number 10 that day, on the day of the murder. And the case would be called. Sean or whomever the juvenile happened to be would be called into a conference room with a juvenile probation officer. In Sean's case, that happened to be Doris Williams. And Sean would be interviewed, and they would ask whether, you know, he took the responsibility for the crime. And there were several, you know, questions that they would ask as part of the process. And at the end of that process, you know, that juvenile probation officer would determine whether there were charges filed against the juvenile. And in Sean Thomas's case, the charges were filed.
And these were the charges of attempting to steal a motorcycle.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, but there's no chance that he could say, you know, I'll take a number and let me just pop out here and, you know, perform a robbery and come back in. There's no possibility of that?
Not at all. No, that's not a facility. Yeah. And Sean was on the second floor of that place, and he was basically locked in until he was released.
And you said it took approximately 2 hours for that process in general?
Yes. What do we understand? Sean appeared when the center opened at 9 a.m. and he left from his recollection around 11 to 11:15 a.m. So how long the actual interview took, maybe 15, 20 minutes, half an hour at the most. But he was in there waiting for a time too. So yeah, but about 2 hours total.
But obviously it would be, even if he had number one, you know, and he was brought in number one, he still wouldn't have enough time to go out and participate in a robbery across town.
No, not at all. And when you examine what the stalwarts testified to at trial, what they said is that the process leading up to the actual crime started, I would say pretty early in the morning, like 7:30, 8 o'clock, where they met in Abbotsford Homes. They decided which cars they were going to take. They drove down to the bank. It was a pretty elaborate story. And it didn't all just happen at one time at 9:55 a.m. when the shot was fired. It was a whole process leading up to that. And several, I would say, crime scenes, Abbotsford Homes, the bank, and then finally the actual scene of the murder, which was 750 West Sedley.
I had a question about the confessions. One thing that was not clear to me in the course of the podcast was I didn't quite understand the leverage that they had over John when they brought him back from from New Jersey, when they actually were able to revive the earlier dormant case. Because to me, it seems like this is a murder case, which is a much worse thing for him to actually confess to. Why would he confess to that instead of the warrant that they had originally issued for him?
Well, the warrant that was issued for him, I think, was actually just a ruse to get him into Philadelphia and to bring him into the homicide unit and have him interrogated. And once he was there, he was interrogated by a person who was famous for eliciting confessions. And he sat him down in that room, and within a couple of hours, John Stallworth had actually confessed to the murder. Now, what happened in that room? We have our own thoughts and beliefs about what that was, and we have some information about what happened in the room to John Stallworth, but for whatever reason it happened to be, John did confess. It was a false confession, but he confessed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but to me, I still don't understand what the police would have as leverage there other than he's stuck in the room. I mean, I understood why William would say something. He was incarcerated and was hoping to get out. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. He was incarcerated. He was hoping to get out, and he was hoping to avoid, you know, life imprisonment. He was also trying to save his brother's life. Not really certain why John confessed. John has been pretty closed mouthed about it. I mean, we've heard allegations of torture, but I'm not sure if that's why he confessed.
I have a bit of a confession, my friends. I have a lifelong addiction to books. I have grown up reading hundreds, if not thousands, of titles since childhood, but adulthood makes things a little bit hard. Things are complicated. There's work, there's family, there's so many things to take care of, but this is how I make up for it. Audiobooks. I listen to audiobooks on Audible all the time because Audible makes getting more books in your life easy. They have an unbeatable selection of audiobooks, and along with an incredible selection, they have the best narrators, really beautifully narrated books by A-list celebrities and award-winning narrators. Now, I just listened to It, the Stephen King book on Audible that's been narrated by actor Steven Weber. He might be one of the best audio narrators I've ever listened to, and hey, I've narrated my own book, so you know that's saying quite a lot. But it was fantastic, and it was such a great trip down memory lane. I recently watched the movie, and I just had to go back and revisit the book, but it's a big book, and I didn't have time to read it again, so it was such a pleasure to listen to it, and so much fun to revisit my childhood memories. So definitely check it out, and you know what? Now our listeners can check it out for absolutely free, because you will get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial at www.audible.com/undisclosed. Once again, that's www.audible.com/undisclosed. Their bestseller list is amazing, and they've always got the latest releases, no matter what your genre, whether it's history, nonfiction, comedy. Nowadays, I'm kind of feeling the horror stuff because we're approaching Halloween, and that's why I recommended It. But anyway, pick whatever you like and listen to it for absolutely free. One last time, that's www.audible.com/undisclosed, and get listening today. I have a question too, and I kind of mentioned this in this episode, and I thought it was odd because, you know, Nathaniel, when he was brought in first, and I'd love to talk a little bit about him and, like, you know, why he was a really vulnerable person, I think, for the police to hone in on, and they didn't pick him up, I think, for a number of years since they had the information from the informant. But after Nathaniel gave them information saying that, yeah, my cousins were involved, I mean, quite a while went by. I think it was like from February to, what was it, October? I mean, it was like 8 or 9 months went by before they picked up John. And I thought that was weird.
It was weird, but I think it's because John was in New Jersey and they had to find a reason to get him over here. They couldn't just go over to New Jersey and kidnap him and bring him, you know, home.
They couldn't issue an arrest warrant for him here based on Nathaniel's statement.
They could, but they weren't going to extradite him because the case had already been dismissed, basically, because... You know, in 1989, at the time of the robbery, the complainant never showed up for court and the case was thrown out. So they weren't going to be able to say, yes, we're going to extradite this guy. So they had to do it sort of on the sly.
No, I guess what I'm saying is, well, I guess what I'm asking is, could they not issue a new arrest warrant based on Nathaniel's statement that he was involved in this murder?
I would think so. But I also think that they had their own doubts about some of the things that Nathaniel told them about some of the facts. And for whatever reason, they chose not to. But yeah, you would think that the reason that they interviewed, you know, Nathaniel Stallworth was to use that information to get arrest warrants. And for whatever reason, they chose not to do that.
Well, I wanted to ask you a question as a former police officer, just in terms of confessions in general. When there are facts that you know are demonstrably false in a confession, how do you weigh what you can use of a confession and not? Because, you know, obviously criminals are often, you know, telling a bunch of untrue things in the course of a confession. How do you find the nugget that might be true in the middle of all that?
Well, I mean, I would think that you usually have the facts in front of you. You know, you've spoken to the witnesses, you know, the gist of what's happened here. So in you know, the case of John Stallworth, these two detectives knew that the witnesses said it was a red and white car, that one witness said it was a gray car, that the witnesses said they saw three people and what those descriptions were. At that time, however, by the time that they had brought John Stallworth in, they had their own theory of the case. And it was a blue car, as we know, and a gray car, and six men. But usually what you would do is you would listen to what they say and you would try to determine whether his facts actually meet your facts, if they're the same facts. I mean, obviously there could be you know, very small discrepancies. You know, the car stopped here instead of there. You know, this guy, you know, you got out at this point. But when you've got totally different cars involved and totally different people than what the witnesses said, you know, something's wrong. When you're telling me that, you know, Louis Gay was there, and Louis Gay was in prison at the time, and we know it, obviously this is a false confession.
Jim, this was actually brought up by John last week when we talked about the first episode. Because my answer to this when John asked was, I don't know. Why did the police accept a story that was so radically different from like one car, three suspects, to two cars, six suspects? I mean, even if they were manipulating witnesses, why couldn't they kind of do it to fit the original narrative? Like, why? Like, because two suspects were never even like charged in this whole thing. I mean, so two people were just out. I mean, that to me was really odd. I mean, does that happen in other cases where they're like, oh, well, I guess we don't get two of them? And I personally could not understand the evolution of the story. Like, why did they get to that? Was it just because Nathaniel had made up so much stuff and they had to just keep going with it?
I don't think they got that from Nathaniel, because they seemed to have that narrative before Nathaniel was ever brought in. They had the blue car because the people in the 39th District had stopped Sean Thomas in a blue car in 1990. They had the four names, you know, from the informant. They had the Thompsons and the Stallworths, as she called them. And so right away, there's more than three people involved. And they just seem to expand it from there. Well, you know, she must know what she's talking about. She's been, you know, a home run before. And for whatever reason, they expanded it to six people in two cars. I'm not really sure why they did that. But we've seen sort of that pattern in a few of these other cases with the same detectives. And I'm not sure how or why that happened.
So in your interview with Rabia, you mentioned that this was a case of the police looking at usual suspects. I don't know, what exactly did you mean by that?
Well, there were several, you know, cases that had been, I would say, put on people in Abbotsford homes. One was, you know, the famous Jimmy Dennis case, in which, you know, he was accused of a murder that he was later freed for. And for whatever reason, you know, the police were looking very hard at, you know, the whole Abbotsford Homes, I don't know, community, for lack of a better word. They were going there and finding people to say that they committed murders. And I'm not really sure where that came from. But a lot of these cases have been thrown out since then. There's been several thrown out, including Sean Thomas's. And when I say the usual suspects, they seem to be going for people who were street criminals. And rather than looking at people who may have been obvious suspects, they looked at people who may be easier targets. It may be easier to prove that this guy did. We can get somebody to say, yeah, he did it, which is what happened, rather than saying, you know, hey, this is going to be a difficult investigation. This might be an inside job.
Does Pennsylvania have anything like a three strikes law?
They do not. We're sent to prison for life after a third felony conviction. No, there's no three strikes law in Pennsylvania.
No, the only reason I ask is part of the reason that the notion was popular in California when it was first introduced was because the idea was to rid the streets of recidivist criminals. It had nothing to do with whether or not that third thing was something genuine or worthy of putting somebody away for life. The idea was that incarcerating the criminal class would eventually lower crime. That's kind of a disturbing idea, but I was curious, did that have any currency with the police at the time?
Well, the idea of I know there was a lot of support for that type of a law in Philadelphia at the time and in the state of Pennsylvania, and I know the police supported it because I heard a lot of cops say so. I probably supported myself at the time. I no longer do, but as to the mentality, maybe that had something to do with looking at the usual suspects. Like, hey, you know, these guys have been involved in crimes before. As we know, Sean stole a motorcycle. He'd been caught doing a few more minor crimes. So maybe it was a way to just say, hey, we can remove this guy from the streets. I'm not really sure, but you know, that may have played a part in it.
I also had one question about, and I don't know if I misheard this during the podcast, but it sounded like when the officer saw Sean in the car in 1993, that the car was a 1993 model. Was I incorrect in hearing that?
No, that's correct. I believe that was a 1993 model. The car that he had been in prior to the Martinez murder was a Cougar. It was a Mercury Cougar, as he described it, blue and tan. And he had been stopped by the same person earlier in 1990 in that car. So there were, you know, in 93, it was a newer car, but, you know, totally different car than what he had been seeing before.
Okay, so they're just pointing out that the guy seems to like blue cars. Is that the theory that they were doing?
Well, I think it's that, you know, those police officers were familiar with Sean Thomas and had stopped him many times and were knew him personally.
And in the intervening time between his arrest for the motorcycle attempted theft, were there any other crimes? I mean, were there other run-ins that he might have had with the police?
Yes. Well, he admitted to selling crack a couple of times in Abbotsford Homes. He said they asked him to roll bundles up there. He did it before. He was arrested for a few minor thefts, but that's it. Nothing, you know, there was no violence. He was never convicted of any violent acts. Basically, what he said was, on the day of the murder, he was stealing motorcycles for a man in the projects who was much older than he was, who was dealing in stolen parts and stolen bikes. And he would get paid for bringing him a stolen motorcycle. And that's what he was doing the night before the murder.
I read that the police officers were also familiar with his brother and father. So I know that Mustafa also had some history. And did John's father also have run-ins with the law?
Sure, his father did have run-ins with the law. He had a long record going back many years.
Can I ask a trial question? Did anyone ever testify about the red and white car actually at the trial?
Yes. The car, the red and white car was mentioned by Alan King on cross-examination. He was asked by Joseph Canuso what color the car was, and he said red. And the judge stopped the proceedings and said, excuse me, what color did you say? And he said red. And she just said, okay, proceed, as if she didn't believe the answer. But yeah, that's the only time that the red car came up.
So it was. I asked because it was so hard to keep track of all the mentions of the car, the pictures of the cars, the Polaroids of cars, and who exactly was introducing them and when. But I think that was part of what the prosecution was going for. It was just to throw all this car information, so much car information at people that they just gave up on that as a subject.
There's a really interesting story behind all those pictures and cars, and we're actually going to cover that in next week's episode.
Okay. Well, I'll enjoy it.
keep the suspense alive.
Okay. Did Sean and Mustafa actually testify in their own defense?
No, they did not. Now, Sean told me that he wanted to, and he was advised that his lawyer thought he had enough to win. In all honesty, so do I. I thought there was enough evidence there, based on the alibi and other things, that Sean would be found not guilty. And it's obvious now that the jury struggled with the verdict, based on the notes that they sent back to the judge. So I don't think it's totally unreasonable for Joe Canuso to say, I think we have enough here for a not guilty, Sean. I don't think you need to testify.
Well, it was interesting as a listener. Obviously, we didn't hear the actual transcripts, but there are obviously baffling things that Canuso left out that he did not challenge and did not confront. But he, wasn't incapacitated like the lawyer in Gary Mitchum Reeves' case. He wasn't on the verge of terrible illness like in Adnan Syed's case. He clearly has some areas of real competence. So does that make ineffective assistance of counsel just completely impossible, or are there enough? Because it seems like there's enough troubling areas, like when the jury requested the signature that was ignored, things like that. Does that allow for ineffective assistance of counsel?
I think so. I think at the time it was a viable claim. But by the time that we got a hold of the case, nearly 20 years later, it was waived. There's no way to raise that because it must be raised within 1 year of conviction. Because there's no way to even say that it's newly discovered facts. Under Pennsylvania's Post-Conviction Relief Act, you must plead that you have newly discovered facts that could not have been discovered through the exercise of due diligence. Well, clearly, people knew back in 1994 that there was a possible claim there of ineffective assistance of counsel. And the fact that those claims were not raised, made them waived.
Would that mean the fact that they weren't raised in a subsequent appeal, make those attorneys who should have raised them subject to, that they were ineffective? Could there be a claim against them? Does it work like that?
Yeah, so layered claim, but they were still waived. That was still many years before. So it should have been brought. Actually, Sean did raise it in his first PCRA. And his lawyer, who at the time was about 1999, I believe it was, 97, 98, 99, I don't know why, but for whatever reason, he dropped those claims. Sean claimed that, my lawyer didn't call the proper witnesses. He didn't assert my alibi properly. You should have called these people. And the lawyer, I don't know why, but for some reason, just did not continue with those claims. He just went on with, with John Stallworth's, alleged recantation. I'm not sure if you want to go into that, but.
Well, we're going to go into that on a later episode. How many appeals has Sean filed throughout the years?
Sean's filed, we've had three total appeals. Sean filed a direct appeal of his conviction, and it was affirmed by the state, by the Pennsylvania Superior Court. He appealed his first PCRA, which was dismissed as untimely in 2000, I believe it was. And that was also affirmed. And finally, we appealed in 2014 the dismissal of Sean's PCRA. And it was still on appeal when the DA decided to go and release Sean from prison.
Which is so remarkable. I'm sure there's going to be an episode about how that process happened because it's so unusual. I mean, actually, for you, Jim, in terms of the people we've talked to, having only a you got this in 2009 and he was freed in 2017. So that's only 8 years in the process. It sounds like that's actually short for these kind of things.
It is kind of short. I fully expected to be going 10 years or more in this case because I knew what the appellate process was going to be. And at the same time that we were in state court, we also had a federal habeas case that was waiting for the state court to finish in case, it was needed. I mean, if the state court did not release Sean, we could have gone into federal court and, had them actually review the actions of the state courts as well. So it could have taken many more years. And I fully expected it to, and so did Sean. So we were, pretty happy when it lasted the short time that it did, which is 8 or 9 minutes.
So my question is, I was really surprised that Sean, got a life sentence without the possibility of parole, not only because he was a juvenile, which is one issue, but also because he was never identified as somebody who committed the actual murder, right? Nobody testified that he had the weapon. It seems like a really, really egregious sentence. And I know that Sean raised the constitutionality of his sentence, given he was a juvenile, a number of times in different appeals. But what about also the issue that, if he was found guilty, I think of second degree, right? Second degree murder. I didn't know that you could get a life sentence without possibility of parole for second degree murder.
Sean was basically convicted, based on the theory of, accomplice liability, which means if you're in for, you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. If you're with someone and you're involved in a robbery or a burglary or a theft or any other felony, and anyone winds up dead for any reason, you're now guilty of second degree murder. And Sean happened to be there, and Sean, they said he happened to be there. And if you believe everything that the state said in Sean's case, they said that he didn't know there was a gun there. He didn't know that anybody was going to be shot. And Sean wasn't there at all, but that's what they claimed about him. Right. And yet still, he was found guilty and sentenced to mandatory life in prison because of our draconian laws in the state of Pennsylvania, which mandate that everybody found guilty of second-degree murder, no matter how old or no matter what his role in that crime is, must get life in prison.
And they weren't offered plea deals, right? Him and his brother, Sean and Mustafa.
No, they did not take a plea deal. I know Sean was offered a plea deal. I'm not sure about his brother. Sean turned it down and said he was innocent.
What happened to the Stallworths after the trial?
William Stallworth served a total of 4 years post-trial, and he was released in 1999. John Stallworth served a little bit longer. I can't remember exactly when he got out, maybe 8 years. But they served much shorter prison sentences than either of the Thomas brothers. John and William were both back in prison a number of times for parole violations, but they're both free today.
So simply because Sean and Mustafa refused to admit guilt, that's the extent of why they're still in prison. Sean was in prison for 23 years, served so much more time.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Sean will tell you that he was brought to police headquarters at 8th and Race a short time after he was arrested. And he was brought into the homicide unit and he was sat down and detectives placed a blank confession in front of him. And they said, sign this and you'll get the same deal as William Stallworth got. And Sean refused. He said, I'm not going to sign anything. I didn't do it. And they said, okay, fine. And he was gone. They sent him back to jail.
What was the reaction of Domingo Martinez's family during the trial? I mean, often the family exerts a real power over the investigation and over the trial, just their presence. Were they involved at all?
I'm told no. Both Sean and William Stallworth have said that they didn't see any of the family members at trial except for the time when they were actually testifying. But they never saw anybody in the audience at all from the family.
Have they made any statements following Sean's release?
As far as I know, they have not.
So considering that we're likely dealing with false confessions here, are there legal ramifications for individuals that provide the false confessions?
Not really, no. There's no way to sue him. I mean, John Stallworth can't be sued for making a false confession. He's going to say he was forced into it. So, no, you can't sue the person who made the false confession, but you can sue the person who actually elicited the false confession.
Oh, so you could, say, sue the police officers?
Yes.
Now, in terms of eliciting false confessions, were you, as a police officer, trained in the Reed technique, the interrogation technique?
I was trained in it in the early 1990s. That's correct.
Did you actually use it, or was it something that it was just sort of a loose framework that you just had in your back pocket?
We rarely used it in narcotics because we didn't do many interrogations. We didn't have to. We usually caught somebody red-handed in narcotics. You either made a personal buy from that person, you bought drugs from him, or you watched him making a sale, or you hit his house with a search warrant and you found drugs. So you usually didn't need a confession from somebody. It would help sometimes if you had a weak case to take him in and say, hey, look, we know what you did, and et cetera, et cetera. And then you may use the Reed technique, which is a very aggressive technique, and it's designed to elicit a confession. But it was very rarely used by us. But, by homicide detectives, I understand it was used frequently.
I do have some listener questions. The first one is from Stephanie Mello, who says, what about his grandmother? Which I assume, is she thinking that his grandmother might have been useful as a witness? Perhaps?
I'm not sure. I'm not certain where that question came from.
Maybe she's just worried about his grandmother. Maybe she's just like, I hope she's okay. Maybe that's what this question is. Does anybody know if his grandmother's okay?
Maybe the question actually is that I think he said that his grandmother died.
Yeah, we didn't say that on the show. Stephanie might be thinking about his mother.
Or who was the one who took him to the...
To the youth study center. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or she just generally wants to know.
Yeah, exactly. How's his mom? we don't know, Stephanie. I'm sorry. We'll try to circle back and get you an answer on that. Okay, here we have one from Tony Flenikin, and this one might hit you where you live, Jim. It says, is critical thinking not required to be a police officer / detective? Red car equals gray car equals blue car is like saying 1 + 1 = dog. Infuriating. Would you like to address that, Jim?
Sure. I understand his question, but I would disagree. I don't think it was done because they were inept and they made a mistake. I think it was done because it was easier to convict Sean and Mustafa based on the evidence that they offered a trial that it was these cars rather than the other cars. And I think the whole thing was contrived. I mean, really, it was basically they looked at this and they thought, well, we can't get a conviction based on all the statements from the eyewitnesses. We have to go with something else. The statements from the eyewitnesses probably wouldn't have convicted Sean Thomas. None of them could identify Sean or Mustafa. So I think they had to create a totally new narrative.
Yes, we got a question from Christina Turi, who's saying, is the problem that police believe all confessions are true or that getting the job done is more important than the truth?
I think it's, obviously I think it's the latter. I think that, getting the job done, especially at that time, and I'm just going to say that in 1990, there were 500 murders in Philadelphia. So I think there was a lot of pressure on these guys to solve murders. Now, be that as it may, I think some of the tactics that they used were, at the very least, questionable. But,
Well, also during the 1990s, it was a very specific time in terms of the perception of crime in the United States. That's when the super predator myth was introduced, which was terrifying to people at the time. So there was a general feeling of helplessness in terms of people demanding that police officers and police forces clamp down on crime somehow.
Exactly. I think there was a whole, take the gloves off mentality on crime. And there was a concept, for whatever reason, I think it was false now, that crime was out of control and the criminal justice system was not working and that we had to do more. And that's when a lot of these mandatory minimum sentences came into play. That's when they were all enacted at the same time. And that's when we tightened down on habeas corpus and PCRA procedure. So, I think that played a big part in that. And, not only Sean Thomas's wrongful conviction, but probably in several others as well.
Jim, I have a question that kind of ties into the last question by Tony Flenikin. And I understand, what you're saying about the critical thinking stuff. And it's they just thought what they're doing is right. And this is what I always wonder about whenever I see these scenarios is that do they really believe that these guys must be the right guys one way or the other? And I've heard this even with Adnan's case and other cases where people say, I don't know how he did it, but I know he did it. And so we just had to find a way to get him, to put him away. Do you think they sincerely believe that these were the actual perps, or they just needed to put away some perps?
In this case, I'm not sure, Rob. Yeah, I know that in some cases they do think that they had the right person. I think they're wrong, and I think that the evidence shows that they're wrong in many cases. But in this case, I'm not certain. I mean, I find it hard to believe that they could really think, knowing what we know and what they knew at the time about Sean Thomas, that he did this crime. I mean, they had to have known that he was at the Youth Study Center when they looked at it. Because any cop would have known that. I knew it as soon as I looked at it. So how they, you know, they would have thought that he actually did it, I'm not sure.
Did you know these detectives, by the way?
I knew who they were. I didn't know them personally. I knew the two police officers from the 39th District, but I did not know the, you know, the homicide detectives personally.
So we've got a couple of questions that are talking about sort of alternate theories of the crime, because as I pointed out in the last addendum, there are things that make no sense. Of course, I didn't do a whole reenactment like Fancy Jim over here with his bevy of law students and such. But I had issues with the crime as presented by the prosecution. So we've got a question from Donkey Hoti, which I love that handle.
Definitely a real name.
Yes. Isn't it public where a winning lotto ticket was bought? Predictable that he would have lots of money that day.
Well, actually, yes, but it was predictable, but it was not well known. Like, in other words, you know, if you believe the Commonwealth's the theory, they did not know this victim, who he was, what, you know, business he was in, if any, and where he was going. They picked him at random, according to the Commonwealth, at the bank. They saw him at the bank and they just decided to rob him and murder him, not knowing how much money he had or where he was going. So, yes, that's true. I mean, it is a public record where lottery tickets were bought and how much was won. But if you believe the Commonwealth, that didn't come into play in this case, because their theory is that Sean and his co-conspirators, if you believe their story, did not know the victim and knew nothing about him.
Yes, we have another question from Jennifer T. Lopez. J-Lo. And she says cops should have looked for a link between bank employees and suspects, since it was routine for victim to go to bank. Yeah, I think a lot of people are thinking along those lines of that there might have been some understanding between somebody either at the bank or, you know, that somebody had some inside information on this. But is there any evidence that the police looked into these type of situations?
They did look into the bank employees. They looked into the teller who waited on Mr. Martinez that day and who took the phone call ordering the money. And they looked at the bank guard, Mr. Davis, who walked Mr. Martinez out of the bank. They interrogated them both. They warned them of their rights and they discounted them as suspects for whatever reason. And I don't think they ever found any evidence at all that they were involved. But I do understand the idea that this seems to have been an inside job.
Well, that's all I've got for listeners' questions. Rabia, did you have any last questions for Jim?
No, I don't think so. I think that kind of covers like what we've talked about in the last couple episodes. There's so much more to the story to come, though. And thank you so much, Jim, for all the work you've done and everybody else at the Innocence Project. And thank you guys also for listening. I mean, I mostly care what you guys think about the episodes.
I think it's great. I think everything you've done is great. Thank you very much for your work.
Oh, no, it's our pleasure. And I look forward to finishing up this conversation in a couple of weeks when we end the series so we can answer all the questions I didn't let you answer today.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Jim.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, John.
Well, that is it for the addendum this week. We will be dropping a new episode next Thursday, and we hope you come back. Remember, all the case documents and photos are posted at undisclosed-podcast.com, as well as a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you all were so generous with last season. And I just wanted to announce that this season, I will be donating all of my fees to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. The Pennsylvania Innocence Project opened its doors back in April of 2009. And in their 8 years of work, they've exonerated 5 men, including Sean Thomas, as well as 1 woman. And in addition to identifying and litigating cases for the convicted innocent, the Pennsylvania Innocence Project works to improve the criminal justice system to prevent innocent people from being convicted. The project also works to promote legislation to loosen Pennsylvania's draconian post-conviction laws to allow convicted individuals a fair chance of having evidence of their innocence presented in court. In addition, the project regularly files Friend of the Court briefs in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and the Superior Court of Pennsylvania, supporting broader interpretation of statutes to benefit the wrongly convicted. So if you can help them out, their website is innocenceprojectpa.org. Please look them up and please donate if you can. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle at UndisclosedPod, and send any more questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. We can actually have an addendum about the addendum addendum. I wanted to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, for his research once again. I also want to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for audio production. If you get a chance to listen to Crime Writers On, Rebecca Lavoie's fantastic podcast, please do. I want to thank Patrick Cortez for composing the addenda theme, and I want to thank Meethal Telhan, our project manager. We love you, Meetha. You've been traveling a lot, but we will want you to travel safely, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next week.